to get the key to the book, Raphael, who is the spokesman, Raphael Heslodei, Raphael is a Hebrew word, a Hebrew name. It means God will heal. Heslodei is Greek for nonsense. Utopia is the Greek word for nowhere, no place. Now, these names themselves provide a key to the framework. Moore had to resort to these names in order to protect himself. There was no freedom of speech, freedom of the press in England at this time. Thomas More could easily have gotten into the worst kind of trouble if he had written the Utopia as if it were his own thoughts, his own beliefs. This was a time of great turmoil in the year 1516. There was a great deal of religious and intellectual excitement. It was the very year before Luther posted his 95 theses on the door of the castle church at Wittenberg. That alone will give you some idea of the nature of the time when this book was published. The Renaissance was at its height, and the Reformation was picking up steam. The Protestant Reformation was getting underway with an awful lot of force and violence. So the thoughts of Thomas More in the Utopia had to be put in the name of somebody, someplace, with respect to whom no account should be taken. I mean, after all, here is a man whose name is nonsense. May the Lord heal him. God have mercy upon him. His mind is all screwed up. The Utopia, no place, nowhere. He's not describing England. He's not describing any place that exists. Funny how perfectly respectable words get mixed up into a lingo that one has to be careful about. Maybe I should learn the lesson of Thomas More a little bit more assiduously. Now let me tell you what I think and what a lot of critics think, though there's no universal agreement on this. The book can be read in different ways and has been read in different ways. There's a whole library of literature on the subject. But by and large, this seems to be the interpretation. The Utopia, the book, assumes a society that is guided only by the law of nature or by reason. Our old Stoic friends. It is ruled by Stoics who knew only the four virtues that can be known by reason, that are part of the law of nature. The four virtues of which Plato wrote and of which the Stoics spoke and wrote. Wisdom, temperance, justice, and courage. Human qualities, human virtues. A pagan could have them. You don't have to be a Christian. You don't have to be a Jew or a Muslim. You don't have to argue that you've heard about these at the foot of Sinai. If you're a human being, anywhere, you ought to, by thought and instinct, come upon these virtues or qualities. So these people of Utopia, the citizens of Utopia, knew of these qualities, these virtues, from reason or the law of nature. They did not have the benefit of any supernatural revelation. But they had a natural theology. There are lots of religions which don't claim that their people stood at the foot of Sinai or had any visions or had any teachings from a man on the cross. Nothing like that. There's a natural theology. There's a whole body of literature, a library full of stuff, a natural theology. Pagans like Socrates had a theology which was natural. Plato, I read to you from Cleanthes, from Epictetus. What did it give them? According to Thomas More, the Utopians had a natural theology which gave them three beliefs. A belief in providence, that is that the universe is organized according to some rational system and that it has a good purpose. It has a meaning, a significance. It's not an anarchy. It's not chaos. Secondly, that man has a soul and that the soul in some way is immortal. Maybe differences of opinion as to in what way it is immortal, but in some way it is immortal. And thirdly, and here there might be some questions about who among the ancient pagan philosophers and theologians had this belief, but some did, some didn't. The others, pretty uniformly, almost everybody, from the time of Socrates on, a belief in rewards and punishments in the afterlife. And that comes very easily if you believe in the soul and if you believe in immortality. Then the next step comes relatively easily, since one is bothered by the problem of suffering. Well, here's an easy answer to the problem of suffering. Now, says Thomas More, or Raphael Hithloday, the Utopians, look at them. They live wisely, decently. They live in some ways an ideal life. There may be some differences of opinion in the year 1973 about some aspects, but you go back to 1516, the contrast was overwhelming. And yet these people were pagans. They had only nature or reason to guide them. They had no revelation. Now look at on the other side. Look at Christendom in the year 1516 in Europe. Christians shared with pagans, as men, the law of nature and reason. All men have that. So Englishmen had the law of nature or of reason. And supposedly they knew about the four cardinal virtues. And in addition to that, they have the revealed religion, which the Utopians didn't have, and a revealed morality, which is part of their religion. A religion and a morality which emphasizes three cardinal Christian virtues: faith, hope, and charity, or love, agape. Yet look at the misery. Look at the degradation all around you in Europe. in so-called Christendom. A disgrace to the very concept of man. Now that seems to be the heart of the idea. In book 2 of the Utopia, now will anyone venture to compare these fair arrangements in Utopia with the so-called justice of other countries, in which I'm damned if I can see the slightest trace of justice or fairness? For what sort of justice do you call this? People like aristocrats, goldsmiths, moneylenders, who either do no work at all or do work that's really not essential, are rewarded for their laziness or their unnecessary activities by a splendid life of luxury. But laborers, coachmen, carpenters, farmhands, who never stop working like cart horses, a job so essential that if they did stop working, they'd bring any country to a standstill within 12 months. What happens to them? They get so little to eat and have such a wretched time that they'd be almost better off if they were cart horses. Then at least they wouldn't work quite so long, such long hours. Their food wouldn't be very much worse. They'd enjoy it more, and they'd have no fears for their future. As it is, they're not only ground down by unrewarding toil in the present, but also worried to death by the prospect of a poverty-stricken old age, since their daily wages aren't enough to support them for one day, let alone leave anything over to be saved up when they're old. Of course, this has a very contemporaneous ring, and read it at any time, even in the year 1973. So it goes on, can you see any fairness or gratitude in a social system which lavishes such great rewards on so-called noblemen, goldsmiths, and people like that, who are either totally unproductive or merely employed in producing luxury goods or entertainment, but makes no such provision for farmhands, coal heavers, laborers, carters, carpenters, without whom society couldn't exist? And the climax of ingratitude comes when they're old and ill and completely destitute. Having taken advantage of them throughout the best years of their lives, society now forgets all the sleepless hours they've spent in its service and repays them for all the vital work they've done by letting them die in misery. What's more, the wretched earnings of the poor are daily whittled away by the rich, not only through private dishonesty, but through public legislation, as if it weren't unjust enough already that the man who contributes most to society should get the least in return. They make it even worse and then arrange for an injustice to be legally described as if it were justice. In fact, when I consider any social system that prevails in the modern world, I cannot, so help me God, see it as anything but a conspiracy of the rich to advance their own interests under the pretext of organizing society. They think up all sorts of tricks and dodges. We call them loopholes in our income tax laws. First for keeping safe their ill-gotten gains, and then for exploiting the poor by buying their labor as cheaply as possible. Once the rich have decided that these tricks and dodges shall be officially recognized by society, which includes, of course, the poor as well as the rich, they acquire the force of law. Thus, an unscrupulous minority is led by insatiable greed to monopolize what would have been enough to supply the needs of a whole population. And yet, how much happier even these people would be in Utopia. Well, you can't help but see what the message is. It comes through once you get the key to this. Now, when we come back, I will spend next week one or two more hours. I'll probably spend Monday and Wednesday on the Utopia, and then we will go on to Locke.